I have not yet preached on this election for a number of reasons. First, I'm a big believer that controversial topics are best addressed in conversation and not from the pulpit where I'm the only voice here. And second, the things I'd like to say, I'm pretty convinced I'm right about. And in preaching, I want God's truth to speak, and I have found that when I am not experiencing enough humility to allow that to happen, that's probably a good sign not to get up here and say it. Third, there's something going on a spiritual level in our culture that is a backdrop in this election, but I haven't really been able to put my finger on it. But I know it's there, and I know it's going to be there long after this election is over, so I'll get another shot at it. But there's definitely something going on that we need to reflect on. And lastly, I think we've needed a break, a place of respite, where we're not hearing constant stuff about what's going on. Yet a colleague said something to me this week that made me think differently about it. That by not saying anything about the election, the church is saying something about the election. So I want to be clear that our faith has a lot to say about the election. It has a lot to say about politics, because it has a lot to say about our communal life, and our political life is something that fundamentally shapes our communal life. In his recent work, Public Faith in Action, How to Think Carefully, Engage Wisely, and Vote with Integrity, theologian Miroslav Volf wrote, "For the most part, Christians have rightly abandoned the false dream associated with the progressivist accounts of history, that if we just keep working at it, eventually, one stone at a time, we will build the new Jerusalem, the city on a hill. But the new Jerusalem, the city on the hill, the kingdom of God, comes from God, not from us. Yet as Christians, we hope for the kingdom of God, and hoping is not merely a mindset or an emotion or a dream. To hope is to live into the reality that we hope for. In the words of Volf, even though we cannot make the kingdom arrive, our lives and our world, including our political societies and global realities, can reflect some of its character. 22 days before the election, the gospel reading today has handed us a model for practicing our faith in the public sphere in this widow. Widows were considered some of the most powerless people of their time, right up there with orphans and refugees. Without a close male relative or economic security, a single woman in the world had an uphill battle just to survive. This widow reminds me of another single woman who the world would consider powerless. She was bedridden with spinal ailments, lameness, and deafness. When she started writing letters to a powerful man she had never met and ended up quite possibly transforming a president. Only 31, stuck in bed, reliant on the care of her parents, Julia Sand didn't think she could do much to make a difference in the world. But it was the attempt on President James Garfield's life that eventually led to his death, and the country's lack of faith in the then vice president, Chester Arthur, that inspired her to start writing to Arthur. Now, Chester Arthur himself wasn't that inspiring. He had led quite a privileged life, thanks to the New York political machine at the time. His political loyalty had earned him a job as the head of the New York Customs House, where he was awarded financially based on the percentage of cargo he seized and fines he levied. Arthur's base salary was $6,500, but he made $50,000 a year. He was quite zealous. In 1880, James Garfield was the compromise candidate for his party, and he was an advocate for overhauling how federal jobs were filled and assigned. But he needed the party support of the New York delegation, so he agreed for Arthur to be his vice presidential candidate. And Arthur, as well as the New York delegation, were staunch benefactors and defenders of the spoils system. Arthur had never been elected to office. But James Garfield was young and healthy, and what did vice presidents do anyway? And that all changed when a mentally ill man, upset that he didn't get a federal job through the spoils system, shoots Garfield. Now, after Garfield was shot, Americans were united in their grief and in their lack of confidence in Chester Arthur becoming president. One newspaper noted, "It's hard to imagine anyone in the country less qualified for the job than Chester Arthur." And it's in the 2 months that Garfield lingers on before dying, while Arthur's likely presidency is bemoaned universally by the whole of American society, that Julius Sand starts writing to him. In her first letter, she is both blunt and encouraging. "The house of Garfield's life are numbered, and before this meets your eye, you may be president. The people are bowed in grief, but do you realize it? Not so much because he is dying as because you are his successor." She goes on to say, "Your kindest opponents say Arthur will try to do right," adding gloomily, "he won't succeed, though making a man president cannot change him. But making a man president can change him. Great emergencies awaken generous traits which have lain dormant half a life. If there is a spark of true nobility in you, now is the occasion to let it shine." Over the course of the next few years, Julia goes on to write Arthur many letters, offering advice, personal reflections, and encouraging him to live into his better nature, all from her bed in her parents' home. Arthur, for his part, does not become the president that the New York political machine had hoped for. He does not reward those who helped put him in office, and in fact, he continues Garfield's plan for overhauling the federal civil service, significantly limiting the power of the spoils system. He is not perfect, but he is not the disaster that many feared. And Arthur offers no explanation as to why he has changed his practices and his beliefs. And there's no evidence that he ever responded to Julia Sand's letters. But while he had almost all of his papers, personal and official, burned a few days before his death, he saved 23 of her letters. Letter after letter to an unjust judge that changed that judge's actions. I am not suggesting that you start writing a candidate motivational letters, though you certainly can. What I'm strongly suggesting is that the perseverance and hope embodied in action are essential to being a person of faith. Our role as Christians in the public sphere is the same regardless of who is elected on November 8th. We strive to follow Christ and in doing so to bring our communal life closer to looking like the kingdom of God. And that means for fighting for justice, serving the marginalized, respecting the fundamental humanity of every person, and walking with humility. Nothing that happens on November 8th changes what we are called to do on the 7th or on the 9th, only the context in which we do it. Election day is important, but it is also a distraction. It is not the turning point for the actions in the public sphere of Christians. Regardless of who wins, reaching out to the other, the ones in our country that we do not understand or connect with, reaching out with hopes of reconciling, is going to be fundamental to having future election cycles that look different than this one. And I think we can all agree that there are a lot more ways our political sphere could reflect the character of the kingdom of God. The widow faced an unjust judge that had no fear of God and no respect for people. And it can feel at times that we face a whole system that embodies that lack of humility and that lack of respect for other people. And we can feel like we lack the power to make a difference. But we can't stop. We can't check out. We can't give up following Christ and working for justice and in speaking truth and in building relationships with the other. Persistence is power. Luke says this passage is about being persistent in prayer. And prayer is not just words between you and God. Prayer is communication with God. And our actions and our relationships and our words communicate plenty to God. When the Son of Man comes, will he find faith on the earth? This passage ends. Just hazarding a guess here, but I don't think when Christ returns, he's going to go looking at the Capitol building or at the White House or on the front page of the prominent newspapers of the time to find faith. He's going to go into our office buildings and the apartment high-rises and the community parks and perhaps even the places of worship and look and see. Are we still begging for justice? Are we shaping a community that welcomes the stranger and builds bridges with the other and cares for the sick and the poor and the struggling? Are we fighting corruption with honesty and transparency? Are we removing barriers to allow all to become who our Creator has made them to be? Are we, in our words and actions, still seeking to live into the teachings of Christ and in doing so shape our communities? Let us hope, hope in word and action that he does.